আর 22 তারিখের মাঝে বাবর ডাউন দজ্জে যাবে কত 17 দিনের
ফায়ার ওয়ান অফ দ্য মেনি থ্রেটস রোহিঙ্গা টেল VOA দে ফেস. It's Monday, April 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Asian hate extends to Canada. Tools for learning down under. John Bolton visits to discuss North Korea. Pandemic tech. Looking back at the past year of COVID. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh are living in renewed fear after deadly fires broke out more than 30 times in the southeastern Cox's Bazar district in recent weeks. Rights activists said these fires are part of a very worrying trend in the overcrowded, sprawling shanty town that is home to dozens of interconnected makeshift refugee settlements. A Cox's Bazar-based Rohingya rights activist, who goes by Hussein, as many Rohingya use only one name, tells VOA he's very concerned about the fires. Every day and every night, Rohingyas across the camp are living in fear that fire will break out again somewhere in the camp. Fires are breaking out time and again, at least 32 times in different parts of the Rohingya camp in Cox's Bazar in the past 17 days after the devastating March 22nd fire. We caught 7 or 8 people red-handed while they were setting ablaze some shacks. They were all handed over to police. About 1 million Rohingya Muslim refugees have been living in the bamboo and tarpaulin shanties in the congested Cox's Bazar district since fleeing military clampdowns in neighboring Myanmar in recent years, according to the United Nations. Sanjeev Kefli, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's delegation head in Bangladesh, told Reuters that more than 17,000 shelters were destroyed and thousands of people were displaced in the area because of the fire last month. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates the fire injured around 550 refugees and left more than 48,000 homeless. While several thousand victims of the March 22nd fire remain without shelter, more incidents of the fire have been reported. Among the refugees is Mohammed Harris, who told VOA refugees live in constant fear. We are very scared. We are passing sleepless nights. That devastating fire on March 22nd destroyed my home completely. Somehow I have built a shack with bamboo and polythene again, taking lots of trouble. With my wife and children, 5 of us are living here. But the way incidents of fire are taking place at one place or another in the camp every day, I fear this house will get burnt to ashes too. Another refugee, Abdu Shakur, tells VOA he believes the fires were caused by arson. Some people are secretly sprinkling a white inflammable powder on the roofs of our shacks. Some others are setting them on fire. It is clear they are not accidents. Some people are setting fire to the shacks as part of a conspiracy. The suspected perpetrators, he said, may be conspiring to scare Rohingya refugees from Cox's Bazar by repeatedly setting fire to their makeshift homes. Bangladesh has set up a facility where it wants to relocate at least 100,000 Rohingya refugees from camps in Cox's Bazar. A few thousand Rohingya have moved to an island in recent months, but most are unwilling to relocate there, saying the island is prone to flooding during high tide and largely disconnected from the mainland. Authorities so far have not said what triggered the devastating fire. Several senior government officials did not respond to questions from VOA asking about the causes of the fires. One mid-level police officer said the cause is rivalry among feuding Rohingya criminal gangs. We thank Sheikh Azizur Rahman for contributing this story. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar security forces kill more than 80 anti-coup protesters. India's concerns over Myanmar drive policy. 8 dead, dozens hurt as Indonesia quake shakes East Java. 2 Christian nurses in Pakistan accused of blasphemy. Blinken faults China for slow response on virus. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Anti-Asian hate crime is on the rise in many parts of the world, including in Vancouver, Canada, according to a new report by the Vancouver Police Department. Home to a large population of ethnic Asians, the Western Canadian city has seen a sharp rise in racist attacks coinciding with the COVID-19 pandemic. Craig McCullough reports.
A recently released report from the Vancouver Police Department shows a 717% increase in hate crimes in the city targeting the Asian community, rising from 12 in 2019 to 98 last year. The numbers mirror disturbing trends in the United States and are startling in a diverse city with a large and well-established Asian community. Government statistics show that 42% of the population of metropolitan Vancouver are of Asian descent. Many families have been in Canada for generations, with their ancestors coming around the 1858 gold rush and to work on building the country's first national railway the following decade. Now, well into 2021, those hate crimes are continuing to get headlines. On March 30th, a 47-year-old was charged with the rarely used public incitement of hatred and mischief to property after writing racist graffiti on windows of the Greater Vancouver Chinese Cultural Center. Fred Kwok, chairperson of the center, says the racist vandalism was planned and intentional.
I would say malicious intent to spread xenophobia to general public. And on top of that, actually, I mentioned that to the police. I said, this is almost like, I can compare that to an act of terrorism that's sole purpose is to put fear in all Chinese.
Queenie Chu is the CEO of Success, a Vancouver-based nonprofit organization that helps new immigrants, predominantly from Asia, in Canada. Chu says there's always been some racism against the Asian community, but politicians in the Western Hemisphere renaming COVID-19 into a Chinese-sounding flu did not help. She's urging more research and documentation on the issue.
One of the ways to do it is to collect of race-based data in consultation with communities, and be open about why and what data is collected and how it will be used to make improvements so that we understand the magnitude of the situation.
Chu also says Canadians must confront systemic racism in Canada, adding that government should fund anti-racism campaigns, including educational initiatives. Constable Tanya Vizantin, spokesperson for the Vancouver Police Department, says the increase in race-based attacks in the city is surprising.
It was quite baffling, especially because we're such a multicultural city. So the fact that there was so much hate towards those of East Asian descent in particular was quite upsetting.
Vizantin says the department has made it easier to report hate crimes online. It is hoped more data and documentation will help the city reverse the trend. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar's military junta says a protest campaign against its rule is dwindling since people wanted peace while 18 ambassadors to the country called in a joint statement for the restoration of democracy. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're starting your week off with us on VOA Asia. Aboriginal tools discovered in a limestone cave in northern Australia are thought to be more than 35,000 years old, and that's deepening understanding of Australia's original residents. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
Eight tools made from kangaroo bone were excavated from Rewi Cave in the southern Kimberley region of Western Australia by archaeologists in the early 1990s. The work was supported by the local Mimbi Aboriginal community. Modern dating techniques have now estimated the carved tools are between 35,000 and 46,000 years old. It would make them the oldest artefacts of their type found in Australia. They were crafted from kangaroo bones to make a range of implements, including spears to hunt birds and fish. The bones could also have been used to make resin as a glue to affix handles onto tools. Academics believe it's rare for the artefacts to have survived the region's harsh climate, where summer temperatures can reach 38 degrees Celsius. Michelle Langley from Griffith University's Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the research provides new information on the lives of Australia's original inhabitants.
From looking at the tiny microscopic scratches and damage on these tools, we're able to identify that some were made for using as spear tips, perhaps, and others for perhaps weaving baskets or working skins. There was a lot of talk about maybe people weren't using bone tools up in the north before about 20,000 years ago, but we now know that that's not true. They were using them, we just weren't finding them.
The study also involved the Australian National University and has been published in the International Journal of Osteoarchaeology. Indigenous settlement in Australia dates to 65,000 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Indonesia President Joko Widodo is hoping to relocate communities affected by flooding and landslides after a tropical cyclone triggered extreme weather, leaving at least 163 people dead and displacing thousands more. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, U.S. President Joe Biden's top advisors are reviewing and formulating their policy toward North Korea, which continues to build its nuclear arms program despite many years of varied attempts to curtail the effort. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke with VOA about North Korea and recent engagement efforts. In the first of three parts, Ambassador Bolton discusses with VOA Korean correspondent Young-kyo Kim about former President Trump's direct top-down style and how that plays into a Biden strategy.
I don't think the top-down approach worked, but I don't think the bottom-up approach will work either. If the objective is an agreement with Kim Jong-un that relies on him promising to give up his nuclear weapons program in exchange for sanctions relief. I think the regime is committed to developing and keeping nuclear weapons. I think they see it as essential to their survival. And while I think they would welcome any relief from economic sanctions, as multiple times in the past, they've demonstrated they're not going to give up the nuclear program voluntarily.
The top-down diplomacy, you think it didn't work at all?
Well, I think it was good for photo opportunities, and I think that's primarily what President Trump saw in it for him. It was clear that Kim Jong-un was willing to trade promises to reduce the nuclear program to get relief from the economic sanctions. But I think we persuaded President Trump that those promises were not good enough. In fact, it has been the case repeatedly that North Korea has promised to give up its nuclear program in exchange for upfront economic benefits. And yet when the benefits are provided, somehow the nuclear program never goes away. And we thought it was important that President Trump not fall prey to that same kind of trap. And he didn't. But the summit diplomacy, I think, gave the Kim Jong-un regime more legitimacy than it should have, and we got nothing in return.
Some experts say, but the top-down diplomacy has its own merits because the North Korean negotiators, they don't have a say in the nuclear weapons. So it could be more practical or more effective if the North Korean leader himself comes out to the talks. What do you say to that?
Well, it depends on what the policy is of the regime from top to bottom. And I don't have any doubt Kim Jong-un basically sets that policy. And I think he was pursuing the same policy his father and his grandfather pursued, and that is they want nuclear weapons. So if they had made a strategic decision to give up the pursuit of nuclear weapons, to renounce the whole concept, then I think negotiations would be fairly easy. But not only have they not made that decision, I think they've consciously made the opposite decision, that they still want nuclear weapons. And until that decision and that objective changes, I don't think there's any real prospect for success. That's why what I call the Libya model of 2003-2004 reflected Muammar Gaddafi's clear decision that he didn't want to pursue nuclear weapons anymore. If Kim ever made that decision, the negotiations would be easy.
Then, based on your experience, when is the right time for the leaders of the U.S. and North Korea to meet? Is there any right time?
Well, I think when there's a new leader in North Korea, and this really goes to the basic point. For many years, both South Korea and the United States and other interested countries like Japan have pursued the denuclearization question. Some have talked about reunification, but it's always been very hazy. I have a view of reunification. I think it's reunification on South Korean terms. And I know people in Korea don't like the comparison with the two Germanys, but here's one place where the comparison is critical. When the wall opened up in Berlin and people from East Germany could go back and forth to West Germany, the East German state collapsed. So if there were true opportunities for people from North Korea to see people from South Korea, the state in North Korea would collapse as well. That's what Kim Jong-un fears. That's why he will never open up. So I think what the United States, South Korea, Japan, really the rest of the world have to do is go to China and say, look, you have unquestioned power in North Korea. You supply 90% or more of North Korea's energy. Your humanitarian assistance keeps the regime afloat. What you need to do is tell North Korea that it's time to revisit what happened in 1945. It's time to reunite the country. I think the United States needs to make the reunification of Korea on the right terms a central element of its China policy.
You said there's when there's a new leader, there could be a summit between the U.S. and North Korea. New leader as in not related to the Kim Jong-un regime.
The key difference between North Korea and other rogue regimes that have sought nuclear weapons, like Saddam Hussein, like the Ayatollahs in Iran, like Muammar Gaddafi, is there really is an easy alternative to the Kim hereditary communist dictatorship, and it's reunification. This is the analogy, really, between Germany and Korea. It is one country. The division of the Korean Peninsula is artificial. It was only intended to be temporary in 1945. Now, Kim Jong-un has a vision of reunifying the Korean Peninsula, too, on his terms, which obviously nobody on our side of this discussion will accept. But I think it's important not to be suckered into a discussion with Kim. Does he want economic benefits from South Korea? Sure. Is he really willing to open up in the same sense as opening a hole in the Berlin Wall was for Germany? Not a chance.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA Korean correspondent Young-Yo Kim. Join us tomorrow for part two, as a possible Biden strategy is discussed and China's role in North Korean diplomacy. Making headlines in Asia, the South Korean tanker ship and its captain that were detained by Iran in January are free after South Korea promised to try to release Iranian funds that have been frozen in South Korean banks because of U.S. sanctions. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the wearable healthcare device market has been growing, especially in the Americas, Europe, and Asia. COVID-19 is causing a boost in demand for these devices. VOA's Elizabeth Lee shows examples of two devices that are finding new purpose during the pandemic.
Imagine a device you can wear that monitors your health at all times without wires or bulky machines. The company BioIntelliSense created the BioButton and BioSticker to do just that.
Things like heart rate, respiratory rate, temperature, 12 different clinical parameters, even coughing frequency.
This reusable BioSticker measures these vital signs every minute. The data is encrypted and transmitted through an app to the cloud every 10 minutes. The patient then receives a health report on the app. The BioButton is similar, but is single-use and measures the heart rate and respiratory rates less frequently. Infected people who don't feel symptoms may actually have changes in their bodies a sensor can detect.
And what we've seen in COVID patients is that there's this characteristic alteration or almost pattern in temperature differential, respiratory rate differential, pulse that precedes actual outward symptoms.
UC Health in Colorado, an investor in BioIntelliSense, uses this device so patients can leave the hospital sooner. The device also allows doctors to remotely monitor the health of patients and people who have received the COVID vaccine.
The device is not meant for COVID. It happens to be ideal for COVID.
Another wearable that was not originally meant for COVID is this AirPop Active Plus Smart Mask.
A silicone seal that's welded in.
This smart mask was first created to filter out air pollution. The removable filter resists liquids and can compete against an N95 mask.
We block over 99% of particulate of the same size.
This halo sensor reads and analyzes the user's breathing behavior.
We understand your breathing and we understand your local air quality. We're able to tell you when to change that filter with a high degree of accuracy.
From data about your mask to your vital signs, all easily accessible through an app. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
At the beginning of the pandemic, VOA's Nina Veshneva met with doctors and nurses in New York City to talk about their experience fighting COVID-19. A year later, she spoke with some of them again. Anna Rice narrates the story.
My name is Dr. Plasencia, Amy Plasencia. I'm a PGY3 internal medicine resident.
We first met Amy Plasencia in the spring of 2020. Then she worked as a resident physician at one of the New York hospitals that were converted into a COVID hospital.
How many patients exactly, if you know?
I don't know the exact number, but I can say that there have been hundreds upon hundreds.
It was a March evening around 7 p.m. Dr. Plasencia was working on a patient in the intensive care unit, and that's when she heard the applause for the medical workers for the first time. Every evening since then, people would applaud the medical staff that helped save lives at the hospital. A new kind of music, the pandemic kind.
1 year ago, we had no idea how to treat this virus. We didn't know what was the best approach, what we could be doing to better help our patients, or if what we were doing was harming our patients. And the volume that we saw, especially here in New York and Brooklyn, was just astronomical.
My name is Calvin Sun. I am an emergency room or emergency physician.
On March 8th, 2020, Dr. Sun came back to the U.S. from Angola. What followed was endless shifts.
How many hours or days you spent during the March in April?
Yeah, I lost count.
Hi, my name is Dr. Robert Gore, and I'm an emergency physician here at SUNY Downstate Medical Center.
For almost 3 months, Dr. Gore lived away from his family because he was too afraid to infect his wife and children with COVID-19.
You know, Dr. King said, you know, the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in times of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. And this is that time of challenge and controversy.
Today, a year since the pandemic hit the country, doctors, health experts, and politicians are assessing what was done right and what could have been done much better to save more lives.
I mean, there's so many lessons to be learned from this. I think there will be a reckoning after something like this is all said and done and everyone's looking back.
Some 550,000 people have died so far in the U.S. from COVID. For years to come, New Yorkers will remember those who passed away, unable to fight the virus, and the thousands of those who risked their lives every day to save them. For Nina Vishnova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can find us as well on Instagram and YouTube. We thank you for joining us today, and we thank our VOA Asia team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.